welcome to the May 9th edition of Ukraine Without Hype. I'm Anthony Bardaway, here with Romeo Kuratsky.
Hey, folks.
So this episode, we're releasing on Victory in Europe Day, the victory in World War II, a very complicated holiday. We talked about it last year. Lots to say, but this year we're not doing that. We are covering a topic very important in the region. It is the protests in Georgia. Mass protests are happening throughout Georgia over what they are referring to as the Russia law, or at least being derisively referred to as the Russia law, while the government and police are increasingly violently cracking down on said protests. This over the Russia law is over how they're doing a foreign agent law, where if an organization receives at least 20% of its funding from foreign sources, it has to register as a foreign agent. We'll get more into what all that means at the end, but first I wanted to do some background over the history of modern Georgia and what brought us to this moment in the country's history. It is a topic that is not something we talk about all the time, and our listeners may not fully understand the entire context as you would about Ukraine from listening to us for all these wonderful years. And, well, the history of Georgia, we can look to the story of Jason and the Golden Fleece. I'm not going to do that to you, but that did take place in Georgia in what was the ancient kingdom of Colchis, so they're very proud of that in the country. But I'm going to look at the breakup of the Soviet Union in 1991 and the events that preceded and followed it. One of the larger trends in the 80s was that a lot of ethnic groups were taking advantage of the increased openness of Gorbachev's Soviet society in order to press their rights more in ways that were previously closed down to them. And one of these effects is that a lot of these ethnic groups found themselves in increasing competition for resources. This happened in Armenia, Azerbaijan. There were clashes between those two groups that eventually led to the Karabakh War, and it happened, I mean, all over the place, but specifically in Georgia, we're looking at the Georgian ethnic group, the Ossetian ethnic group, and the Abkhaz ethnic group. Most of these, we're not going to get into like the fine differences in, you know, national costume or anything about that, but understand that these are three groups that existed within Georgia. And so there are a boiling set of conflicts between these ethnic groups in the late 80s. And then when it came time for independence, they began to escalate. So yeah, just keep that in mind that these ethnic groups had some political conflicts with each other in the waning years of the Soviet Union. So then you look at the independence of Georgia. The first president of the country, Zviad Gamashkurya, was a civil rights activist, an academic, a dissident. It was a common type. In Ukraine, we had people like the Rukh, who were that similar type of guy. And unfortunately, other elements within the Georgian political scene did not especially like that very much, leading to a coup against him later that year, starting in 1991, followed by a civil war between those who supported Gamashkurya and those who supported Eduard Shevardnadze. Eduard Shevardnadze led the coup against the first president, and he was an especially powerful figure because he was actually Gorbachev's foreign minister. So if you look at the 80s, all the foreign policy moves, in that era, the detente, perestroika, a lot of that is partially the responsibility of Shevardnadze. Long story short, he wins this civil war, Shevardnadze wins the civil war, and becomes the leader of the country for the rest of the 90s up until 2003. However, because of the instability caused by this civil war, it led to the simmering conflicts in Abkhazia and Ossetia to flare up into full-scale war. The Abkhaz and Ossetian separatists were supported by the Russian military, and in fact, a lot of it was came down to, even in the late Soviet period, they were really inflaming these ethnic conflicts in order to keep the successor states of the Soviet Union as weak as possible. They tried to do this in Crimea as well. So they supported Abkhazian and Ossetian separatists. There was a hot war. Initially, the Georgians had a bit more success, but because of the support of Russia, eventually the separatists won their conflicts. Abkhazia especially saw the Abkhaz separatists ethnically cleanse Georgians and other non-Abkhaz from the region, creating a massive refugee crisis. These refugees mostly went into Mingrelia. Mingrelia also happened to be the region where they were supporting the initial president's Gamash Kurdia's side in the civil war. So compounding factors led to a very difficult political situation for Shevardnadze to step into. Though he did win this civil war, he now had two separatist regions who were basically controlled by the Russian military, and the Mingrelia region that was still mostly populated by his enemies during the civil war, who maintained an armed insurgency and attacked into Abkhazia. On top of that, there was the problem of Adjara, another region of Georgia. Keep in mind that Georgia is a very small country, so I'm listing all of these regions. They're all very close to each other and do not contain a large amount of people, but many of them had their own problems leading to the Georgian 90s. And in Adjara, there was basically a local strongman named Aslan Abashidze, who ruled over the region basically as a semi-independent entity. So on top of that, Georgia suffered a lot of problems of corruption. There was a ton of organized crime within the Russian-speaking mafia. The Georgians form a very significant faction, the most conservative and traditionalist faction, really. And these thieves in law were themselves basically warlords. It was a hard time to be a Georgian. And to make matters even worse, shortly after these wars in Ossetia and Abkhazia, right after that was all done with, began the Chechen War, which took place immediately north of the Caucasus Mountains, and which led to a lot of refugees into Georgia. All the other wars and conflicts of the North Caucasus and South Caucasus, again, small area. So Nagorno-Karabakh War was happening very shortly after that. A lot of political instability in this time period.
I would just like to note that while these areas are small, they are incredibly mountainous. So it isn't always a straight path from one region to another, and that very often there's really only one road that snakes through, like the only pass to connect these the various regions. As a result, despite like the geographic closeness of a lot of these regions, in practice, especially when you deal with poor roads and unsuitable vehicles, it can really take a long time to get from one place to another. Of course, this is less relevant in the modern day, but especially in the 90s when cars were pretty scarce, fuel was incredibly expensive. That definitely added to kind of the distance between a lot of these regions and why they were embroiled in so many kind of inter-ethnic conflicts.
Yeah, and before I pause to describe the end of how that era ended, people say that the Soviet Union ended in a peaceful way. It did not. And Georgia is an excellent example of it not being a peaceful end. Of course, we can also look at Armenia, Azerbaijan, look at Moldova.
It was the Chechen Wars. It was peaceful only from the perspective of the West. For the people living here, it was not.
Multiple wars in Central Asia, the Tajik Civil War, like, it was not as peaceful as it's made out to be. So this situation where now Shevardnadze is ruling over everything that I just described up until, like I said, 2003. 2003 was something called the Rose Revolution. And starting from about 2001, the early 2000s, there was an increased disintegration of that political system that arose in the 90s. One by one, different political factions began to peel off away from the Shevardnadze government. The most popular leader of these kind of splinter factions was a young Mikhail Saakashvili, who will kind of be our protagonist going forward. And in 2003, that is, in the wake, there was a kind of contested parliamentary election, accusations of fraud and corruption, etc. And this Rose Revolution was called that because at one point the supporters of the revolution backed by Saakashvili went into the parliament with a bunch of roses. This is considered one of the color revolutions of the time period. They take heavy influence from the bulldozer revolution in Serbia in 2000 that overthrew Slobodan Milosevic, and other color, quote-unquote color revolutions followed, especially in various parts of the former Soviet Union. There was the Orange Revolution in Ukraine. A bunch of places had similar revolutions that were not especially ideological in nature, but were more about better governance, which I suppose is its own form of ideology when the opposition is just corruption. The revolution succeeded. The Shevardnadze government was replaced by Saakashvili, or Saakashvili and his allies. And the Saakashvili government did a lot of what's considered westernization, good governance types of reforms. It was a very heavily reformist movement. So among these, he said that the traffic police are beyond corrupt, so he got rid of them entirely. He fired the entirety of the traffic police, along with much of the interior ministry, was replaced entirely. He targeted organized crime. He basically did a version of a Georgian RICO Act, where he made the simple act of being a thief in law, which was a classification within organized crime, the highest level, he made just being a thief in law a crime on its own without needing other crimes to back it up. So very similar to how RICO is treated in the United States. And because of that, many of these mob bosses fled the country, many of them to Russia. There is also a big push for digitalization. So instead of having to do all your paperwork with all these different forms, he wanted it so that anything you had to file could be done immediately at the station and put a lot of it online. Which does not sound like that big of a deal, but when you talk to Georgians from that time period, I think that's the one they're most proud of. Cutting through red tape is something of a blessing and is something that Ukraine tried to copy after Maidan. He also did a lot of English language education, and similar to Ukraine, though not as severe, there was the issue of Russian being, you know, the language of high culture in Georgia that kind of suppressed Georgian national consciousness, and Saakashvili thought it would be better if Georgians were more English literate and did not have to rely on Russian as much. So now there is a divide within Georgian society of if you grew up within the Saakashvili era, you probably speak English, and if not, then you probably speak Russian, in addition to, of course, your native language of Georgian. But on the grand scale, the thing that ended up causing the most dramatic changes for Georgia as a country had to do with what I call state reconsolidation. So the very first thing to happen after the Rose Revolution was that the Adjara region, the region that I mentioned that's kind of on the border with Turkey that was semi-independent, the leader of that region rejected the Rose Revolution, and Saakashvili did a show of force with special forces, went in, said, that's not how this is going to work. The Abashidze, the leader of this region, got no support from the other political factions within the region, and so he fled the country for Russia. Everyone, when they're done doing their horrible things, ends up back in Russia.
Gee, I wonder why. I wonder what it is about Russia that just draws in all these petty warlords and corrupt influence brokers. There's no answer. Russia's a great nation, great culture. No idea why all these evil assholes would run there after doing all their evil shit. to avoid consequences for all their evil shit at home.
Yeah, it's the retirement home for mafiosi. The other region that I mentioned, Mingrelia, the region that backed the losing side of the Civil War and was largely ungovernable during the 90s, well, they were happy to see that their oppressor be replaced. Saakashvili reached out to them, told them how, like, their leader was a national hero of Georgia who led Georgian independence. And since then, they've been more incorporated into the Georgian system. It's not like a particularist region like it used to be. But then you have to look at South Ossetia and Abkhazia, the two regions that were not just semi-independent, kind of doing their own thing, but literally just occupied by Russia. And Saakashvili had to look at, how do we solve this problem? How do we make these regions part of Georgia again, that had all these refugees who fled there, who have Russian weapons pointed at us at all times? How do we solve this problem? And began to kind of make more plans to find ways to reincorporate them back into the country. And so there was this standoff that occurred between Georgian forces and the Abkhazian South Ossetian forces, which leaves us at 2008. So there's a lot of versions of how the 2008 war began, but I'll give the one that seems most plausible to me and has the most evidence backing it up, which is essentially that, yes, there was this state of tension between the Georgians and South Ossetians. But at some point, the South Ossetians began shelling Georgian towns, like within government-controlled Georgian towns. And this exchange happened for quite a bit. Now, if it had occurred before Saakashvili's kind of pro-Westernization, the Georgians probably would have just taken it on the chin. Who knows how many people would have died, because the South Ossetians would just kept on shelling Georgians, and the Georgians knowing they couldn't respond without Russian interference. But Saakashvili felt that because he had more backing of the West than the country had in the past, he had more latitude in order to respond to this aggression, which proved to be a very fatal mistake, because he did not. So Georgia responds by moving into Shkinovali, the capital of the South Ossetia region, because, again, he feels like he has enough international backing to kind of ward the Russians off a bit. But at that point, Russia moves in to protect this region, as I said, by invading through, well, Romeo mentioned that a lot of these areas are connected by a single road. There's literally a one tunnel that goes between Russia and Georgian Ossetia. So they had to go through a tunnel to get there. But yeah, so in 2008, these Russians invade Georgia through this tunnel. They quickly overrun Georgian forces that had kind of taken Shkinovali, and they go move on from there. From South Ossetia, they move on to the Gori region. The city of Gori in Georgia is bombed heavily by the Russians. A lot of people die. A lot of the images that come from Gori in this time period will be familiar. Knowing the Ukraine war, you know, bombed out cities, gruesome stuff, but again, because it's a small country, this was only a very short road from Gori onto Tbilisi. The Russians occupied many towns and cities on the way between these two places, stopping short of the capital city of Georgia, Tbilisi. Meanwhile, Abkhazia, the Russian forces in Abkhazia also expanded their zone of control, taking over more area than they had occupied than before. But this goes on for about 2 weeks before a peace deal, which ends with Russia recognizing South Ossetia and Abkhazia as independent countries. And ever since then, even after the cessation of formal hostilities, Russia has done a creeping annexation where every once in a while they will, you know, take that border fence that runs between South Ossetia and Georgia proper and kind of move it a couple meters forward. And there have been cases of people falling asleep in Georgia night and waking up to finding themselves under Russian occupation the next morning.
There was a documentary, I believe, on Vice that came out around 2014, 2015, which literally showcased this farmer in the back of his kind of property juts into Russian occupied territory. And he went out and showed the documentarians how the Russians have moved the fence from the quote unquote official kind of line of demarcation or border, whatever you want to call it. And it moved like 100 meters closer to his house over the course of, what is it, like 8 years or something. So it's like they were just literally, the Russian soldiers, as this farmer was describing it, the Russian soldiers would literally sneak out of their bases at night to like move the fence. Just utterly petty kind of bickering neighbor garbage.
Yeah, when Anthony Bourdain did his Georgia episode as well, he went to, you know, this region, and the people there are like, yeah, so that's my mom's house over there. We used to live in the same village, except now she lives in Russian occupied area and I live over here. So we have to like wave at each other over the fence. But this disaster of a war, which the West really should have stepped in to prevent, and because they did not prevent this war, obviously led to the invasion of Ukraine. There were Ukrainian commentators, even at the time of the Russo-Georgian War, who were saying that nothing was done about this, so we're obviously next. And they were treated as paranoid then and were obviously proven true.
The popular view in Ukraine and abroad of the 08 war, at least prior to 14, and probably a little bit after, but prior to 14, around the time it took place and afterwards, was that the Georgians, quote unquote, deserved it because they unprovokedly attacked South Ossetia and Russia was just, you know, protecting its these vulnerable areas. This was not just Ukrainians, but you would find Western Georgian experts, pretty much anyone who had an opinion for reasons I back then did not understand. And I still don't understand now. They all blamed Saakashvili for Putin deciding to invade Georgia. It was a wild time.
Yeah, hopefully in hindsight, we know that this was just one more in a series of events that chained into the current events. But while Russia said that these areas were quote unquote independent countries, we've been talking them as they were. They were just Russian occupied. Their military forces had long since been fully incorporated into the Russian Southern Military District, the military district that also ended up in control of Donbass. Their state budgets are majority supplied by the Russian government. They are just Russian provinces in territory that's formerly a part of Georgia. So this occupation continues on to today. The Russians are in the process anyway of building a very large naval base in Abkhazia. It's a whole mess, but this was also the beginning of the end for the Saakashvili government. As Romeo just said, he was largely blamed for the war, or even if not blamed for the war, then allowing it to happen as it did. And that began a series of setbacks for him. There were more accusations of him being increasingly autocratic, of him, yes, passing these reforms that may make certain things better for people, but at the same time, consolidating power around himself and kind of weakening democracy in the process. I am hesitant to give a ruling on that because I do not know Georgia as well, but that is kind of the consensus view that I hear from people. And because of that, he eventually lost more and more popularity until 2013, when he could not run for a third term as president, so he did not have that position, and his party lost power to the party that's currently in power, Georgia Dream. And so keep that in mind. 2013 was the turnover to the current system that rules Georgia under the Georgia Dream Party. The Georgia Dream Party is a project of Bidzina Ivanishvili. At the time of his ascension in Georgian politics, he was not actually a Georgian citizen. He was a Russian citizen. He did not obtain Georgian citizenship until a little bit later.
Ivanishvili is pretty much your bog standard Russian oligarch. He made his money in the 90s in metals and banking. And if anyone, you guys know anything about Russia in the 90s in metals and banking, those are very euphemistic cover words for just mafia stuff, because pretty much every Russian oligarch made their money in some combination of metals, banking, or fossil fuels. Those are the three things that drives the Russian economy. Those are the three things that still drives the Russian economy. Of course, Ivanishvili got rich off of that and backed Yeltsin's presidency in 96. He was pretty popular at the time, or at least he was popular in Russia for being a quote-unquote progressive oligarch.
So Ivanishvili, pretty classical Russian oligarch who had a limited connection to Georgia until he decided to run the country, essentially. And because Georgia is not a huge country, was not especially economically developed, still is not like a huge industrial superpower or anything like that, the oligarchy there is much smaller scale than it is in Russia. Russia is the big leagues. He came down from the big leagues to a smaller team, essentially, and was able to use his substantial resources from being a Russian oligarch to purchase political power within Georgia. So yeah, his party under Ivanishvili of the Georgia Dream becomes the ruling party in Georgia and still is today. So those are the guys in charge. So when we say government, that's who we mean. And the Georgia Dream Party, even though it was controlled by this Russian oligarch, he couldn't exactly make it a fully pro-Russia country. This is a country that had only recently been invaded by Russia. The popular opinion in Georgia is strongly pro-Western, pro-reform, pro-modernization.
At the same time, Georgia is a very Orthodox Christian country. They take Orthodox Christianity to be a core part of their identity and their culture. And as I hope our previous episodes have let you guys know, that the Orthodox Church, especially any church connected to the Russian Orthodox Church, which the Georgian Orthodox Church is just a branch of the Russian Special Services. So there was always this kind of avenue for influence, which has only kind of increased since GD took power.
Yeah, and the Georgian church is quite powerful within society. When I was in Georgia, one of the people there was talking to me about how they had these big parties in the mountains surrounding Tbilisi. Tbilisi's in a valley, and all around it, it's all these really tall mountains. And they said how they would always party up there until at one point, the Georgian Orthodox Church got mad at them for having these parties, and there's like this whole war of like the church trying to shut them down and all that. So it is quite influential. So under this government, they have continued on a pro-European path, but more reluctantly than before, we can say. Their heart isn't in it as much. So this situation took place where before this transition happened, Georgia, Ukraine, and Moldova were all super neck and neck to see who would, they were all working together to join the European Union, to make the necessary reforms to join the European Union. And within the group, Georgia was really the leader of that group. After the Euromaidan revolution, a lot of Georgian experts came to Ukraine to help set up various things, such as digitalization of the bureaucracy, for example. And that included Saakashvili himself. Saakashvili was in exile from Georgia because of his conflicts with Georgia Dream and was invited to become the governor of the Odessa region in Ukraine. So for the first brief period of time after Maidan, Saakashvili was the head of Odessa region until he eventually ran afoul of the city authorities in Odessa and then later Poroshenko himself, leading to him to be stripped of that position. And it's a very eventful life, but Anyway, so these Georgian experts were a big part of reform in Ukraine, so it was always seen as kind of the leader of this group. But over time, more and more problems happened where they sandbagged on more reforms, they broke more promises, until they really fell behind both. So this really began to show itself more strongly in 2022, where after the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, the European Union moved forward to be more assertive in inviting Ukraine, Moldova, and Georgia into candidate status for the EU, saying, if you follow these reforms, then you'll eventually join the European Union. And ever since then, especially, they've been hitting far fewer of the marks than Ukraine and Moldova have. They are really in last place when they used to be in first. And this included, again, going back to Saakashvili. Saakashvili tried to return to Georgia, where he was arrested and basically tortured. And he, when you see pictures and video of him now, he does not look to be in very good condition. He's lost like half of his weight. He's gone on hunger strike. Different observers are basically accusing the Georgian government of torturing him, which has also reduced their ability to meet EU standards. So then from 2022 to 2023, there's now something called this foreign agent law, which is, as I said, this law that says if you make more than 20% of your funding from foreign sources, register as a foreign agent. And I guess now we explain what that really means. Civil society is very important in Georgia, just like it is very important in Ukraine. And a lot of their funding comes from European Union, from different foundations like the Ford Foundation, Soros, get that Soros money. And this has always been something they don't like. We'll get more into a discussion later, but the real reason they don't want to do this is because these NGOs, these civil society groups, are the ones kind of pushing for anti-corruption, for good governance. They're accusing all the Georgia Dream politicians and judges and all that of malfeasance, and they don't want that watchdog there anymore, and so are passing this law to begin the process of cracking down on them.
The law is really not one what one would call democratically minded. As Anthony already said, it forces all entities, and this doesn't just apply to NGOs and civil society organizations, but literally any entity in Georgia that quote unquote receives 20% or more of its funding from a foreign entity, and it's not clear how that is calculated. It can't be clear for reasons that will be made obvious very shortly. So not only does any entity with this arbitrary limit have to register, but they have to comply with, quite frankly, insane reporting requirements. They have to make themselves available for surprise searches by the cops at basically any time for any reason. They have very little legal recourse to contest searches, seizures, arbitrary detentions, and so on. It is basically being branded a pariah, legally speaking. It's not a law really that should apply to any organization. But the way Russia has used the foreign agents law has been very obvious. They just tar anyone they don't like with that and then say, well, these are foreigners disrupting our glorious country and culture, and get them out of here.
And it's being referred to as the Russia law because it is basically a copy of the Russian foreign agent law, which was passed in 2012. Now, 2012 was a real turning point in Russian history. This was in the midst of the return of Vladimir Putin from the prime ministership to the presidency. There were mass protests against him, the Bolotnaya protests. And the Russian state made a transition from what it was before, whatever it was before, to a much more authoritarian system that saw all these civil society groups that were never strong, but wanted to eliminate them entirely. So beginning in 2012, they used this foreign agent law in Russia to at first just label organizations as being foreign agents, and then over time using that labeling to treat them as criminals, to have these searches, to accuse them of various crimes, to accuse them of being spies, until now Russian civil society functionally no longer exists. And the creation of that foreign agent law was a very important step in that authoritarian process. So the Georgians don't want that to happen there as well.
Nationalism, as always, remains the most convenient scapegoat for totalitarians.
So that brings us to now. This law was originally proposed last year, but because of the mass protests against it, it got delayed and delayed and delayed until now they finally decide to pass it through parliament. And because of that, the country has exploded. Now, part of this is that it is pitting the president, Salome Zurabishvili, against the prime minister, Irakli Kobakhidze, with the president opposing the law and the prime minister supporting it. And because of that, President Salome has been being treated like an enemy of the people now. There are massive crackdowns on these protests. Now, I want to get more information in later episodes from Georgians themselves. So this is a very just brief overview of what's going on the streets. But as the weeks have gone on, the police have become more and more violent in putting down these protesters. They have also begun the practice of, well, I don't know what they're called in Georgia, but in Ukraine, the word for them is tatushki. During the Maidan Revolution, the cops, at least initially, were trying to avoid doing most of the skull cracking themselves. So there would just be mysterious groups of young men in black clothing with like meth face, essentially.
Your local rent-a-thugs, if you went down to any bar with 20 something layabouts and you gave them $100 each to show up at a thing and punch quote unquote liberals. That's literally what a tatushki is.
Yeah, so that was a big part of the strategy of putting down the Maidan Revolution. Obviously, it didn't work, but it kind of became a symbol of the era. These rent-a-thugs used by the police to crack skulls with baseball bats. And that's what's happening now in Georgia. These groups of black-clad athletic young men is often the euphemism used in the media for these people to beat up protesters. A lot of the leaders of this movement have already been assaulted. Like, they go back to their house, they're followed, and while they're near their home, they've been, like, beaten up. Nobody's been killed yet, but
literally just a matter of time.
They're escalating.
Threats against protesters and opposition leaders have intensified. People have reported getting, as a new development, are now getting personal threats, personal phone calls on their phones, telling them to, you know, back off or else. So given that there does not seem to be a swift resolution of this whole thing, it's very likely that sooner or later someone's going to kick it.
Rhetoric is also getting extreme on the government side. There are now posters being put up saying, like, these leaders, the protests, are enemies of the people. One very bizarre one is that members of the government have been referring to the protesters as, like, without a nation. So, like, they literally use rootless cosmopolitanism as the protesters. If, for those who don't know, rootless cosmopolitans was a Soviet euphemism for Jews. People who do not belong to any nation and are therefore like shifty and can't be trusted because they aren't loyal to a particular place. Sounds pretty Nazi. Well, the Soviet Union was kind of Nazi.
It was a pretty fascist place, yeah. And though I do wonder at the efficacy of that, because it's harder to paint your opponents as Jews when there are no Jews around.
Yeah, they're basically calling protesters Jews. Like, you're being anti-Semitic against Georgians. Like, congratulations, Georgian protesters, you're now Jews. Welcome to the club. It kind of sucks sometimes. That was the strangest rhetoric, at least to me, was this nationless accusation. But they've also been doubling down on this conservative aspect in other ways. They are trying to pass anti-LGBT legislation. The Georgian church is being very pro-government. Some of them are even being explicitly anti-Western, which is not as common within the Georgian political scene, where they are saying how the West is trying to drag us into war with Russia. We need this law to keep Western influence away from us. Everything that has been implicit is becoming explicit, and that's scary. And like other things, like the prime minister is going to go to CPAC Hungary, which the Conservative Political Action Conference, an American political conservative conference. They have their branch in Hungary now where they basically see Orban as the ideal political leader. So now Prime Minister of Georgia is joining that movement as well, which is not a good sign.
Fascists understand perfectly well that you need solidarity to achieve results.
Nationalist International, I guess, but this is opening up two question marks that I feel really need to be discussed, because there has been disinformation from not that many sources. There's really only one who's operating in the English language space. I will not refer to her name to give her the boost, but you know who she is, who's been making articles about how this war against the NGOs, these NGOs have been destroying Georgian democracy. Let's have a counter narrative to that anyway. So one thing that is being compared to is how the United States has its own FARA law, where in the United States, if you are an agent of a foreign government, you have to register yourself as such. This is not a super commonly used law, but it has been used more often recently, considering how aggressive Russia has been trying to influence American politics. And a lot of the Trump team, for example, has been caught the FARA Act. And this foreign agents law in Georgia is just saying, oh, you have the FARA Act, this is the same thing, what's the problem? And no, it's not the same thing.
It's completely different. First off, the FARA Act explicitly defines what the hell an agent of a foreign principal is, and it has nothing to do with the funding. It is a thing the government has to prove. It has to prove that you take orders from a foreign source if you are subject to FARA. So this is immediately like miles less oppressive or repressive than the foreign agents law in Georgia and Russia. On top of that, it explicitly excludes media organizations like news or press services. Again, unlike Russia and Georgia, where Russia, one of the first targets of this foreign agent law, was basically every single independent media outlet in the country. That was their first target. And again, the FARA Act explicitly carves out an exemption for media organizations, for news and press services of a foreign power to not be subject to this act. And on top of that, it doesn't do anything other than require, in practice, all it really does is require lobbyists who are working on behalf of a foreign government to tell the United States government that their lobbying activity is in fact being directed by a foreign government. That's it. That is all the law does.
Whereas in the case of the Georgian law, say that you work on, I don't know, elementary school education or something like that, and you apply for a grant from George Soros, let's just say George Soros, because that name is going to become more important in a second here, and from the Open Society Foundation, and you're able to use this grant to be able to print out a bunch of booklets that teach whatever your methodology is, and you distribute them to 5 schools. So you take out the grant to pay for the booklets to print out to take to the schools. Well, that money to teach kids English, let's just say, came from a foreign source. So now you're a foreign agent and subject to random searches by the police, who will probably not use that information for any good purposes. That is a very obvious difference between the FARA Act. It's not at all the same. Don't say it's the same. And this question of NGOs is the other thing we have to talk about is, okay, I will present it as it is. The fact is that Georgian civil society is in large part made up of these NGOs. These NGOs were non-government organizations, began to become more popular in the late 90s, early 2000s. And a lot of very young, talented people flocked to them that wanted to make their country better. Like I said, education reform, election monitors, infrastructure, anything that you can think of wanting your society to improve, there can be an NGO there to help do it. So if you're an NGO worker in the United States, it's not a high-paying job most of the time. It's not, you know, there's not a whole lot of money in it. But the kind of money that is lower middle class in the United States can go a long way elsewhere in the world. So these NGOs were able to pay a pretty livable salary to its employees that existed in developing countries like Georgia, like Ukraine, like elsewhere. It is very common for there to be a kind of educated middle class in many countries throughout Eastern Europe, former Soviet Union, throughout Asia, throughout Africa, who have Western educations that are supported by this or that foundation, who want to make their country better and do that through foreign-funded NGOs. To me, that doesn't sound so bad. Whenever people complain about the influence of NGOs, I want them to be specific. What exactly thing are you mad about NGOs doing? Are you mad at them for making that English language school? Are you mad at them for creating this dance troupe for kids? Like, what specifically are you mad at them for doing? And often it's like just vague nonsense. And just for the purpose of transparency here, I come from the NGO world. My initial work in Ukraine was much more focused on doing various things for NGOs. I have some background in like fundraising for NGOs. So obviously I'm biased to say that these organizations are fine because obviously I thought they were fine enough to go work for them. But then there's the complaint is that this isn't the government doing it. This is not like controlled by democratic processes. And to that, I say democracy is not just voting. It's civil society, it's activism, it's doing your part in your community. And starting an NGO is not that hard. If you want to get something done, that is the framework that exists within our neoliberal world is through NGOs. Would it be interesting if it was done through something like a mutual aid society or something like that? Sure, that would be great. But the money has to come from somewhere if you want to make big changes. Reforms cost money. Building things costs money. Hiring experts, educating experts costs money. That money has to come from somewhere, and that money does not, in many cases, exist within these countries. So it comes from countries that are wealthier. That is what foreign funding of NGOs is. If society does not like what an NGO is doing, you can always just not have them do that. They need permissions from local governments. They need the permits. They are always very tightly monitored. There's always lots of reporting. A NGO in these countries will have cleaner books than just about anyone, because they have to report it to very bureaucratic places in the West, whereas not always the case with strictly local. It's all open. It's all transparent. If you have a particular complaint, say what that complaint is. That's the main thing I have to say about that. And of course, they did play a big part in the Rose Revolution, which is, as I said, the real reason why these power players in these countries don't like NGOs, and why people connected to these NGOs, such as George Soros, are treated like demons, because they said that the government had to do a good job at being a government, and the people in that government got very mad. They do not like having oversight. They do not like things improving as a general rule. These crooks prefer everyone to wallow in misery so they can rule over the ashes.
Listen, it's hard to extract rent from an efficient system. You can only extract rent via the inefficiencies. If you start getting rid of those inefficiencies, how are people supposed to afford buying another Dacia? were a third car sending their kids to school in London.
Because of that, they, like I said, there were a whole bunch of Georgia Dream politicians who are under corruption investigation right now by these NGOs. They do not want oversight, so they're trying to weaken and get rid of this entirely. And if you think that getting rid of these NGOs will create a better society, you're wrong. They will be replaced by bastards. That's just how it goes. Like, even in Ukraine, from some more dubious corners, there had always been distrust towards civil society, saying that these people, you know, just live fat off of Western money. It's not that much money. I've seen the money. It's not that much. Though, at least in Ukraine, especially with the war, one of these kind of leaders of the Ukrainian civil society, much of it funded through these foreign channels, is Alexandra Matvichuk, who won a Nobel Prize for her work in civil rights and protecting Ukraine. And she has been a major advocate for the country. She helps raise a lot of money for humanitarian causes in the military. And like, she's an important person, and she comes out of this world. And that is what these crooks are afraid of. They don't want people to come up in the world through their goodness and their helpfulness, but rather through criminality. So that's where we stand right now. I just had to give my defense of NGOs. I don't know, anything more you have to say about NGOs, Romeo?
Like, you covered the whole thing pretty conclusively. The only thing I'll say is, especially here, and this applies less to more developed countries, but especially in Ukraine, and likely the same thing is true in Georgia, NGOs often are some of the only ways to really jumpstart a career. If you are interested in human rights or journalism, or education or any number of things, because official salaries are just laughably low, and often below the actual poverty line, and there's not, you know, much else to do other than work for an oligarch, NGOs offer a career path for people to actually develop themselves without selling their soul or subsisting on Gretschka and mustard for the rest of their life, which some people do choose, and props to them. But they really do serve as this kind of engine of upward mobility. As weird as it sounds, because again, if your salary is $3,000, $4,000 a month, in the US, that's not much. In these countries, this is basically the height of luxury. You are in the top, like, 1% of earners in Ukraine.
No one's making $3,000 a month at these places either.
No, but why? I've seen NGO positions that offer $2,000, $3,000. That's not, like, that's not beyond the pale.
I'm referring more to, like, the local ones, if you're talking about a big American NGO that has an office in Ukraine. Yes, they will pay pretty substantially.
Yeah, exactly. And often you just won't find those kinds of salaries anywhere else in your country, aside from high-ranking positions at oligarch-owned businesses, and that's it. Those are your options. And as a result, a lot of people learn a lot of their values. A lot of things in Ukraine and Georgia and a lot of Moldova, you know, these former Soviet countries that are trying to actually improve themselves, they often, you will often find people who actually hold on to, let's call them liberal values, much more earnestly and sincerely than their counterparts in the United States, because they really do believe in what they're doing, and they're kind of fairly compensated for it, which probably says something. But unfortunately, we don't quite have time to get into that. In summation, NGOs can be good. Sometimes they're bad. But generally, if you want to completely ban people from, you know, distributing pamphlets or holding conferences or running workshops, then you're probably doing a fascism. And you should stop that. Shouldn't do a fascism. As always, on this podcast, fascism bad.
Don't do fascism, y'all. So that is where we'll close off this episode. In the future, we do want to kind of keep you updated on the comings and goings, maybe get some more insight of what's going on in Georgia. The thing with Georgia is because it is so deeply connected to Ukraine. I mean, walk down, I'm two blocks away from a Georgian, like three Georgian restaurants, like culturally very connected in that way. A lot of Georgians in Ukrainian civil society, like I described, a ton of Georgians in the Ukrainian armed forces. Georgian Legion, of course, is one of the like long running and, you know, great units within the Ukrainian military defending us now. Really, if there's a brotherly nation of Ukraine, a lot of people would probably say Georgia or, you know, Poland or something, but Georgia ranks high on that list. So we do really need to watch what's going on. So awaiting that new information, hopefully more of it good than bad. Let's hope that this is a peaceful correction to the established order and not a bloody crackdown. I'm very afraid of that. But until we get that information, until next week, glory to Georgia. If you would like to learn more about Ukraine, please go to the link in our description, and it will contain a list of various resources about Ukraine and charities you can donate to. If you'd like to support Ukraine Without Hype, the best thing you can do is tell your friends about it, tell your family about it, share it, like, rate, everything you can do to help get the word out about us at Ukraine Without Hype. That would be much appreciated. If you'd like to support us financially, you can go to patreon.com/UkraineWithoutHype. And join our list of patrons, including access to our Discord server. So thank you very much to Deborah Grazer, Randy McNerlin, the voices in my head are from Big Pharma, David Shepard, Giorgio, Vana Kukratskaya, Michael Drucker, Anna Karen Person, Anonymous, Dennis Napalm, Devi, Dimitri Litvin, Etienne Soleil, James Burke, Jan, Yanara, Jenny Louise, Kevin Albertin, Marguerite, Michael Wickman, Mike Perrone, PLM, Shieldwall, Silas Frank, T. Bart, Vivek, Adam Poppenheimer, Aiden McDonald, Alex Grochmal, Anastasia, Barbara, Captain Technical, Chris Benning, Daniel Spring, David Wall, Emily Bavona, Francois, Grace Krause, Head to Laugh, Jacob Poem, James Wise, Jared Bradley, Jerd, Julia Lindsay, Laura De Leon, Lori Halila, Levy Grove, Marianne, Matt Miller, Anonymous, Hart, Paul Bailey, RDK, Sanjay, Scott Berry, Scott Gengris, Scott Taukiuk, Stuart Akers, Subtle Knife, Thomas Sobiek, Veronica, Victoria Leontaneva, and Wandering Lens. Thank you all very much for your support and what make this all possible. So until next week, Slava Ukraini!